We're going to begin momentarily. So please ask everyone to find a seat. I'm Steve Morrison, director of the Health Policy Center, Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS, and I want to welcome all of you here on this beautiful spring morning to CSIS. We're delighted today to host Dr. Thomas R. Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I also wish to welcome the many over 150 people who are joining us online. We've made a special effort in this last year to build the community of folks interested in global health issues through our smartglobalhealth.org site, and that is working. We're building participation. Many who are online have submitted questions, and we'll be drawing on those later in the program. I also wish to offer special thanks to several individuals who worked very hard to make this event happen. From CSIS, Emily Poster, Seth Gannon, and Daniel Porter made very special contributions. From the CDC, special thanks are due to Anstis Brand, Sarah Handy, David Bodden, Catherine Harbin, and Donald Shriver, among others. We developed a very close relationship with CDC beginning in late 2001, when John Hamry, our president, CEO, and I ventured to Atlanta. As we were thinking about how to launch a CSIS task force on HIV/AIDS with then Senators Frist and John Kerry, and we were in very much in need of expert partners to help us from within the USG to guide our efforts. And we received very ample and sustained support from Jeff Copeland, Steve Blount, Phil Nyberg, Helene Gale, and they became very integral to our success. Phil has been with us for 6 years now after having departed from CDC. Helene Gale has gone on to other positions and been a very strong friend and ally of ours, most recently as co-chair of the CSIS Commission on Smart Global Health Policy. We remain very indebted to CDC and very admiring, and we look forward to building our relationship further, especially now as the new Center for Global Health there takes shape and evolves. An epidemiologist and infectious disease expert, Dr. Frieden, took up his current duties as director of CDC almost 1 year ago. It's a good moment, I think, for us to pause and to hear his reflections from that first year and looking forward as to what lies ahead for CDC. For some time, Dr. Frieden has been in our sights as a leader in a hurry with a special mission for bringing about major changes in public health. He brought to his new position at CDC a strong reputation built upon his 7 years as commissioner of the New York City Health Department, a reputation for bold action, for structural interventions, free condoms, controls on smoking, elimination of trans fats, and a remarkable ability to navigate complex political waters. And along the way, he was able, through that combination of skills and determination, to achieve major changes in public health that many regarded as really politically infeasible, but which he proved wrong. In New York City in 1992 to 96, as Assistant Commissioner for Health, he curtailed an epidemic of drug-resistant TB and thereafter carried some of that skill and determination to India, where the programs that he was involved in managing cured over 100 persons living with TB. In his 7 years as New York City Health Commissioner, he brought about a dramatic decline in cigarette smoking, reductions by half among teenagers, and eliminated trans fats from the city's restaurant. It has not been the same for French fries and donuts in New York City. The spirit of this approach is very much in evidence today in his leadership at CDC and the quickly evolving U.S. agenda there on the domestic side to tackle obesity, reduce salt intake, confront the multitude of related chronic disorders that increasingly beset Americans' health. He's also brought to his post a broad vision of the expanding role that CDC can play in promoting global health, the subject of his presentation today. I recall reading this time last year the article that he published, the very timely piece in Global Public Health, laying out in a very comprehensive and compelling way, an article with K.J. Henning, his view of the key priorities looking forward. It was comprehensive, it was forward-leaning, and it was very pragmatic. Over the course of the past year, we organized here at CSIS the CS Commission on Smart Global Health Policy, brought together 25 leaders to help us in that effort, issued that report March 18th. We've asked Dr. Frieden to offer whatever observations he has today. This event really is meant to be a follow-on to that. And over the course of the Commission's work, we benefited directly from Dr. Frieden's generosity and advice. He came and addressed the group on October 16th. The Commission took a very special interest in the field epidemiological training program and as a model for building preparedness in partner governments for pandemic threats. And as you will read in the report, we emphasize the degree to which many major U.S. health institutions were expanding in their engagement in global health. And certainly CDC stands out as among the most dramatic transformations that have occurred in the past decade. Under Dr. Frieden's leadership, one of the largest changes in the CDC structure is the elevation and consolidation of CDC's global health work into the newly launched Center for Global Health, now to be directed by Kevin DeCock, known to many of you, along with Don Schreiber's role here as the Washington-based deputy. We're looking forward this morning to hearing from Dr. Frieden on how this new center will be operating. Dr. Frieden will speak for 20 or 25 minutes, and then we'll have a roundtable discussion and invite comment and questions from you all here. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Frieden.
What I thought I would do is just start with a reflection of my involvement with both global health and CDC. I began in working in global health in the early 1980s, working in Central America. And when I joined CDC, I joined an institution that is really infused with both technical excellence and a deep sense of caring and commitment. I finished training as EIS officer. I then went stayed in New York City, where we were able to drastically reduce drug-resistant tuberculosis and tuberculosis generally, and then was very fortunate and privileged to be able to go to India. Both the New York City job and the India job were actually as a CDC employee on loan or secondment to first the New York City Health Department, then the World Health Organization, and in India I was paid by CDC, working with WHO, officially at the regional office of WHO, often at the country office, but actually working with the Ministry of Health, but really with the state and local governments of India, but actually funded by the World Bank. The project was funded by the World Bank. So the complexity and importance of global health work really can't be understated. And there was one particular incident that brought home to me the interconnectedness of our world. In India, one of the things I did was to help the government set up very effective TB treatment services, diagnosis, treatment, management. And we did that all over the country. We had places in Bihar where the program worked well, and those were very important to us because then we could go to Kerala and Tamil Nadu and say, you know, they can do it in Bihar. I don't know why you can't do it here. And, of course, for those of you who worked in India, that would be a real challenge. And I would be politically incorrect if I made the analogy of what that would be in the U.S. from one jurisdiction to another. But suffice to say that was very motivating. And one of the places that we implemented in Kerala, really the most developed from a health standpoint state in India, happened to be the hometown of a man who I had treated in New York City. And I had treated him in New York City for extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis. It had taken 3 to 4 years, but he had been cured. He had had surgery. He had had multiple experimental treatments. He had had severe side effects of his treatment. It had cost well over $100,000 to cure him. It would be probably about $500,000 in today's today's dollars and today's treatment. And to have prevented his case in his hometown would have cost $10. So that, I think, brought home the both our interconnectedness and the potential impact of our efforts in global health. And one of the reasons, there are lots of reasons to work in global health. There are our own security. We're all connected by the air we breathe. There is soft or smart power, and the fact that countries will think better of us if we help them live longer and healthier lives. There's a productive economy. We want trading partners, which are vibrant. But fundamentally, it's about what's right and helping people live longer and healthier lives when there are means easily within our grasp to do so is what's right. And I'm going to outline some of the plots and themes for our Center for Global Health. The themes, I think, are to strengthen the use of data to manage programs on the one hand, and to strengthen the government on the other. And those are obviously very closely related, to strengthen the governmental or public health systems. Those are two essential aspects. And I want to show you a slide that I pulled off the internet yesterday. This is data from India. Each of those borders is one of the 600 or so districts of India. And this is data from up till December 31st of 2009. So it's data that's less than 6 months old. It's publicly available. And it outlines district by district who's doing well, who's doing okay, and who's doing poorly in terms of the different districts of India. In the past 10 years, the government of India has treated 11 million people with the DOTS program. This is tuberculosis control, and has prevented about 2 million deaths by doing so. This is an example of data that's used to manage programs and as a public accountability system. It's data that strengthens the government's ability to manage and improve programs. So that was the theme of data and government, or public sector. Now the plot for our Center for Global Health. First, capacity development. And I think your report from CSIS on smart global health really got it right in terms of what's important to do, what's important to focus on, where are the areas where we can make the most difference. And I really congratulate you on the release of the report. It sets a high bar, and it's important that we all recognize that we can advance our own interests by investing strategically in global health. And one of the key areas is capacity development, because capacity development then feeds into global health security, a second key plot of our Center for Global Health, and also feeds into helping people live longer, healthier lives. Those are the three subplots of our Center for Global Health: capacity development, global health security, and helping people live longer, healthier lives. By doing those things, we will generate data you can trust, data that means something, not simply the best guesses that we have, but actually data that is used in program and that can be relied on to make decisions, and a public health sector that can get things done. Because much as we would like to take a shortcut and work around that, in the long run, there are no shortcuts. We need to strengthen public health capacity in developing countries, and doing that will be critical to everything that we want to accomplish and try to accomplish in the future. So starting with longer, healthier lives, the first of those three subplots. And again, I think the CSIS report was quite important to emphasize the importance of maintaining the fight against HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and highlighting the importance of good data to tailor prevention on this, and of prioritizing women and children in our global health efforts, something which is also a cardinal feature of the Global Health Initiative. In terms of helping people live longer, healthier lives, there are disease-specific programs, HIV, TB, malaria, immunization, neglected tropical diseases, and more. Also, the prevention of chronic conditions and injuries, and accurate data and knowledge generation for effective global public health action. We need to do two things. One is implement what we know works that we're not implementing, and second, learn more about the things that we don't yet understand well enough to prevent effectively. HIV. Support for prevention of mother-to-child HIV transmission has been provided in about 16 million pregnancies in recent years. More than 300,000 babies have been born without HIV as a result of these efforts. It is not as extensive as it should be yet. It's increasing very rapidly. In FY09, the number of HIV infections prevented was almost the same as it had been in the past 3 years, almost as large. So we see an increasingly effective protection of the new generation, the next generation, in Africa and elsewhere. Antiretroviral treatment provided to nearly 2.5 million men, women, and children, about half of all of the people on treatment globally. Support for ministries of health in at least 35 countries, support for planning, resource mobilization, training, supervision, and the establishment of information systems, which I feel is often one of the most important things that we can establish and leave behind. An effective system so that countries can understand what's happening and manage their own program, like the system I showed you in that first slide from India. That's a system that was set up 10 years ago or more, and it continues to operate on a quarterly basis and be used to manage and improve programs. Tuberculosis. 36 million tuberculosis patients have been cured in the past 15 years. About 5 million deaths have been prevented as a result, many of them in India. And in recent years, it's up to about 700,000 deaths prevented per year. There is, though, still a need to strengthen the basic provision of tuberculosis control services, or DOTS. There are still too many countries where there are drug stockouts, where microscopes aren't working, where microscopy is not high quality, where directly observed treatment is not done in a way that supports patients as the VIP of the program, and where supervision is not done. Supervision is critically important for all public health programs. I have sometimes fantasized about writing some personal reflections about my time in global health, and I thought I would title them, "Nobody Loves a Jeep." Because it's very hard to get development agencies to fund things like supervision. It seems like it's unnecessary, and yet it's essential if we're going to do anything well. Supervision by national staff of national programs. So tuberculosis control is a success story. There are limitations, particularly in the context of HIV, but there are also very major challenges, both to implement what we know now and also to learn new things so we can do better. Malaria, we can reduce illness and death by half in high-burden countries. We need to implement what's known and develop new strategies as well. One of the things that CDC has done is to document the effectiveness of rapid diagnostic tests for treatment and surveillance. Very important. As you use indoor residual spraying and insecticide-treated nets, what happens is that malaria is drastically reduced. And when you do that, you then find that doctors are treating up to 90% of the people they're treating for malaria don't have it. So that's a tremendous waste of resources, and it's very dangerous, because that means if they have pneumonia or diarrheal disease or other problems, meningitis, they're not getting treated effectively for it. So particularly as we scale up ITN and IRS, we need to scale up RDTs, all those alphabet soup of malaria, rapid diagnostic tests, so we can know who actually has malaria. That can help us to target our prevention programs, to improve our treatment, to conserve our resources. And conserving resources is going to be critically important. All over the world, despite recent upticks in the stock market, all over the world we're faced with a tremendous fiscal challenge. And we need to make sure that every dollar we have gets stretched as far as it can be stretched. And to support ministries of health, I want to go back for a minute to HIV, because I think it's possible for us to forget what a tremendous success PEPFAR has been. I have colleagues in various countries in Africa who describe to me or have written eloquently about the impact of AIDS on their countries. There are countries in Africa where 2/3 of all adult deaths were from HIV in recent years. And what the scale-up of antiretroviral treatment has done is to drastically reduce those numbers and extend life for millions of people, as well as probably to reduce the spread of HIV at this point, where you've not seen a change in risk behavior, as we saw in this country. Neglected tropical diseases, we can eliminate lymphatic filariasis, and we can eliminate onchocerciasis in the Americas. There's an important role of monitoring and evaluating both drug therapies and delivery strategies. Some recent work at CDC identifies ways in the state of Orissa where you can, with some community-based education programs, drastically improve uptake of mass drug administration, something that's critically important to understand. Technical assistance for monitoring and evaluation, helping the World Health Organization, and another key aspect of the CSIS report was the importance of making smart investments in multilateral institutions. We need to provide support to WHO, UNICEF, and many others, the World Bank, of course, Global Fund. It should all be really a partnership to have effective, cost-effective support to countries around the world for specific health outcomes. Of course, one of the things we do at CDC is to second staff. As I was seconded to WHO, we second staff to WHO, UNICEF, the World Bank, and elsewhere to work in partnership on common goals. Non-communicable diseases and injuries. In many developing countries, there are now twice as many deaths from non-communicable diseases and injuries as there are from infectious diseases. Even in sub-Saharan Africa, there are nearly as many NCD deaths as there are from communicable disease deaths. When we go to country speaking only of an infectious disease agenda, countries are very disappointed. They say, but what about what most people are dying from now? And there's a lot that we can do in non-communicable disease control. There are some real winnable battles. Tobacco control, implementation of the WHO Empower package of taxation, smoke-free workplaces, hard-hitting warnings, restrictions on advertising, and increasing tobacco taxes can make an enormous difference. In New York City, we were able to decrease the number of smokers over a six-year period from 21.5% to less than 16%. That's 350,000 fewer smokers in 6 years. We don't yet have the follow-on information from Uruguay. You know, Uruguay has the best tobacco control program in the world. Why would that be? Anyone know? Their president is an oncologist. And he decided they would do it right. And I think that emphasizes one of the key points about global health, which is that many decisions are political decisions. And one of the things that we're so delighted about in the partnership on the Global Health Initiative is the high-level involvement of the State Department, USAID, Global AIDS Coordination in global health issues more generally, because ambassadors, the State Department, can help countries raise the profile of health on the agenda. I'll tell you a story from my many years in tuberculosis control. There was a country where I worked for a time where their most promising public health expert was a young man who, and their biggest problem at the time was malaria. So he was in charge of malaria. And then for reasons that were never clear, in his early 30s, he had a massive stroke and became aphasic. So he couldn't speak. He could understand and kind of express himself a little bit. And so they didn't quite know what to do with him. They took him out of the malaria program and they put him where nobody else, you know, didn't matter. It was a sleepy backwater. They put him in the tuberculosis control program because nobody cared about that program. And over the ensuing 5 to 10 years, he gradually recovered and began running one of the best programs in the country, in the region, actually in the world, and became a model tuberculosis control program. But that dynamic, which tuberculosis control services felt, we'll put it there because nobody else really cares that much about it, is unfortunately the dynamic that many ministries of health face in developing countries, where who's going to become the health minister is the person who didn't get their top seven choices as minister. So this is something that we face, and the commitment politically to increase this is critically important and particularly seen in all of the disease control programs. If you look at the DOTS strategy for tuberculosis control, the first component is political commitment. And if you look at non-communicable disease control, whether it's tobacco or alcohol or injuries, road traffic, the food industry, artificial trans fat, all of these things require political leadership. But many countries lack the basic means to even understand what the burden of non-communicable disease is or begin to address it. There's a need to link public health action and policy change to build public health capacity in developing countries, and obviously to address these leading causes. Second, global health security. And again, the CSIS report highlights this in many ways. Clearly, we are all connected by the air we breathe, and there's a lot that we need to do together. Weak surveillance in any country is a risk to all of us. We need coordinated systems to detect and respond to infectious diseases, and we need quicker identification. So, for example, if H1N1 had been identified in Mexico 2 months earlier, when it was almost certainly circulating, we would have had a two-month jumpstart on vaccine production, and vaccine would have been available in large quantities before, not after, the major disease peak in the U.S. That would have had an impact and would have resulted in millions fewer illnesses and hospitalizations and thousands fewer deaths. So our lives depend on good global surveillance. And that's going to require strengthening ministries of health in public health emergency response and also in the establishment and maintenance of surveillance and strategic information systems, critically important. The international health regulations empower the international community to prevent and respond to outbreaks or hazards that can cross borders and threaten lives and economic stability. Effective June, 3 years ago, the regulations require that countries report outbreaks to WHO. There are nearly 200 ratifying countries, and they have a requirement, a responsibility, to strengthen their surveillance and response capacity. And that surveillance and response capacity is core to what CDC can bring to the table in our global health work, in our capacity to develop in development in particular. As your report indicated, we need to ensure that we have the capacity to support our ambitions, and we need to help other countries have that capacity. If we think about the basic information systems out there, start with vital registration. Most of the world will live and die without an accurate or even any record of their existence. This is a critical problem. It's a human rights problem because for people to have documentation of their existence is important. And it's a critical problem for us in evaluating the impact of our interventions. William Farr, great biostatistician and epidemiologist in the 1800s in the UK, said, "The death rate is a fact. Everything else is an inference." And we can't even measure the death rate accurately in much of the world today. So we're making inferences upon inferences instead of resting our information on firm ground. The way to fix that, I think, is starting with capacity development. We need to address infectious as well as emerging threats, as well as non-communicable diseases and injury. We need to increase the number of trained epidemiologists to at least one per every 200,000 people around the world. There's been a lot of attention, and appropriately so, to the lack of doctors and nurses in developing countries, but you see almost nothing written about the lack of epidemiologists, the lack of public health specialists. And yet, public health is a best buy. By implementing public health programs, we can prevent many conditions and reduce the burden on the healthcare system. We need to develop epidemiologists with specialized expertise in both communicable and non-communicable diseases, in both laboratory work and zoonotic work. And we need tiered models of epidemiologic training, which I'll show you a bit about in a minute. We need to strengthen ministries of health for surveillance, provide technical expertise on immunization and other areas, and conduct research, including operational research, to understand better what we need to do. Surveillance systems can be an optimal tool for monitoring and evaluation. And I want to just spend a minute on this concept because it's, I think, very important. Many countries have systems in place. They tend to be poorly utilized and poor quality data. But it is possible to improve them and make them sustainable. And when you do that, you help a country have a system which can improve the treatment of individual patients, improve the management of clinical and public health programs, and serve as a critical infrastructure for that country. I'll give you three examples. One is tuberculosis control, near and dear to my heart, has, I believe, the optimal information system of any public health program. Every single patient who's suspected of having tuberculosis is registered, everyone diagnosed is registered, and every program is accountable for the outcome of every single patient diagnosed. I wish in this country we had a system that good for our leading causes of illness and death, like hypertension and high cholesterol, but we don't. That doesn't mean they can't be developed, and we're working on that with a lot of progress being made through the National Coordination of Health IT, aimed to have over 100,000 doctors on electronic health records agreeing on a standard set of definitions, but a lot of work has to happen to make that come true. The same is true for HIV, and what you see in the top is a touch screen means of providing TB treatment in Malawi, I'm sorry, HIV treatment in Malawi, that allows the management of large quantities of information by people who do not have a high degree of computer literacy, and has been done really on a shoestring with a little bit of support from CDC and other groups as well. And at the bottom, you see the tuberculosis register. On paper, the record of every person treated, their type of diagnosis, and their outcome. In malaria, countries such as Senegal have begun scaling up a system whereby they use rapid diagnostic tests so they know actually who has malaria, not just who has fever, and they can then use that to target and improve their programs. This is much more sustainable and has much more positive impact in the country than an external survey or even an internal survey that gets done. That doesn't mean there's no role for surveys. Although they're less likely to build capacity or contribute to program management, they can be essential for planning and evaluation to know, is there a problem? Right now, I'll talk a little bit about our work in Haiti in a moment, but one of the things that we don't fully understand is the burden of malaria or filariasis. This would be critically important in helping the country to determine how to deploy and optimally use their resources. The field epidemiology training program of CDC may be the single most important thing we do in global health. Since 1980, 31 FETPs have trained more than 1,200 epidemiologists. More than 80% of them stay in their countries after graduating, generally in a leadership role in public health. Just in 1 year, there were nearly 300 active trainees conducting 300 outbreak investigations all over the world, discovering new pathogens, new syndromes, responding to outbreaks, and critically, helping to build host institutions. It's effective, it's low cost, it's practical epidemiology training, but it has reached so far only a small proportion of the numbers needed. The pyramidal model of epidemiology training is something that we've begun more recently. These FETP trainees are 2-year intensive practical epidemiology training based on the Epidemic Intelligence Service model of the U.S. But what they've added are two additional units because they realize that it's great to have an epidemiologist who can analyze data if it comes in a valid format, but if you don't have people who can report it in a valid format, that's a problem. So they created a basic level, basic epidemiology tools, a training over 5 months of about 9 or 10 days duration, but most of the time actually practical work, and an intermediate level at the provincial or state level where dozens of epidemiologists would be trained over 9 to 12 months over about 20 to 30 days. So developing people who would not only be able to improve the quality of reporting, but serve as a career path for people who could then enter the FETPs, and also provide mentorship and dissemination of culture on the importance of valid data that you can trust. I think the future of FETP is it needs to be better, bigger, broader. Better, we need to ensure quality control in all of the countries where we're active. We need to have specialized tracks in HIV, malaria, immunization, TB, NTDs, injury, NCDs, and much more, MCH, so that we're helping to develop the cadre of staff who will be the subject matter experts and leaders in their countries. Bill Fagy said something very interesting about EIS. He said EIS is, everyone understands how important it is to turn out effective staff. But the most important thing that EIS did for CDC was not to generate staff at CDC. It was not to provide staff for state and local health departments, so that was critically important. To run EIS well, the CDC had to become better as an institution. It needed to develop its laboratories, its statistical skills, its writing skills, the MMWR, all of that was essential to be an effective host to EIS. And that's what the FETP programs around the world should increasingly do. It needs to be bigger. We need a larger reach at national and subnational levels. It'll be 100 or 200 years before there are enough epidemiologists in places like India and China, and 50 to 100 years in Nigeria at the current rates that we're going. So we need to support that. And for the pyramidal model, we need multiple levels of epidemiologists and broader, affecting or addressing non-communicable diseases, healthcare systems, economic analysis, and more. A second key building block after epidemiologic capacity, or hand-in-hand, I should say, with epidemiologic capacity, is strengthening global laboratory capacity. This is one of the most concrete, useful aspects of health system strengthening. A lot of people talk about health system strengthening. It's sometimes hard to know what specifically that means. But certainly having competent laboratories that can diagnose cases at the national, referral, and clinical levels is critically important. Training that addresses sustainable, accredited laboratories, coordinating epidemiology and laboratory development. So you have your laboratory capacities match the epidemiologic needs of a country, and you have the epidemiologic work build on the laboratory findings of that country is critically important. And focusing on achievable goals and maximizing existing tools. And we have many cases where there are slight improvements in the quality of diagnosis, whether it's rapid diagnostic tests for malaria or LED fluorescent microscopy or LED microscopy, at least for tuberculosis, which can really scale up diagnosis and treatment just as rapid HIV testing has scaled up testing and treatment for HIV. A third critical area where CDC has been particularly effective is in-country technical support. This is critically important. We embed staff in ministries of health, either directly or through partner institutions such as WHO, and we're there side by side helping to design, implement programs. Those specialists have a link, have an anchor back in Atlanta with a link to thousands of leading disease control experts, to 40 WHO collaborating centers at CDC, critical partnerships on the international scene with WHO, UNICEF, and others, and very close coordination with USAID. And I'm very optimistic that as the coming months and years move forward, that will become even stronger with the Global Health Initiative. Better data, more effective public health action. A couple of examples. Nigeria. In 2006, H5N1 avian flu arrives, but was not detected for about a year due to lack of in-country surveillance capacity. CDC partnered with the World Health Organization and the Nigerian Ministry of Health to develop a surveillance system within the existing healthcare system and to establish a field epidemiology training program, which will just turn out its first graduates this year. This is the kind of thing that we can do and do well and rapidly. Haiti provides a tremendous challenge and a very important responsibility and opportunity. The devastation of the poorest country in the Americas calls on all of us to do everything we can to help it build better than before. Some of the areas that we're working in partnership with USAID and others have to do with malaria and neglected tropical disease elimination framework. There's a lot that we can do to better understand and target our efforts. Resources are always going to be limited, so targeting and making them stretch as far as possible is important. One of the key issues that has to be dealt with is the addition of hepatitis B and Haemophilus vaccines to the standard vaccine package in Haiti. Right now, they don't have a high vaccine coverage even for routine vaccines, and yet they're not using relatively low-cost vaccines that could make a big difference. And as we think about a global trust fund or a Haiti trust fund, we need to think about investing intelligently or smart global health, what we can do to save the most lives with the most sustainable systems. Through PEPFAR, we're providing antiretroviral care and support, and we're preventing maternal child transmission. One of the areas that we need to work on better is coordination around family planning, because maternal child transmission programs have not currently done a lot of family planning, and that's unfortunate, because it's a need and a demand of many of the women in service that should be provided. We're also looking at the National Tuberculosis Control Program, which has many strong international partners, important to restore treatment, do case finding, improve laboratory capacity, and build long-term capacity. In terms of health security, surveillance for preventable illness in camp is being done in camps and nationally. The surveillance system in Haiti leaves a lot to be desired, but we've been able to strengthen its ability to collect information and get some baseline. We've been able to disseminate pre-decisional briefs on conditions of outbreak potential so that we would be ready to respond to the more likely situations which may occur. And we've supported PAHO Health and water sanitation hygiene clusters, UNICEF nutrition work with secondments, with technical support to develop water quality monitoring, sanitation, and other work in close partnership, and all of this with USAID as the lead agency for the U.S. For capacity development, we want to adapt that pyramidal model to begin short-term trainings and work to establish an FETP in Haiti and to strengthen the laboratory capacity. The laboratory in Haiti is functional. It did not fall down. The Ministry of Health did fall down. It was destroyed with significant loss of life, as you may know, in Haiti. But the laboratory continued to function, and we've been able to work with them to strengthen their capacities. They're getting an increasing number of specimens in. They're documenting and responding to outbreaks. They're ruling out rumors of outbreaks. And we're helping to establish a new national blood center. Global Health Initiative. There are ambitious targets to the Global Health Initiative. Preventing 12 million new HIV infections, treating more than 4 million people, reducing under 5 mortality by more than a third, saving 3 million lives, reducing maternal mortality by a third, reducing TB by half, malaria by half, NTDs by half, preventing more than 50 million unintended pregnancies, and reducing child nutrition by 30%. These are measurable, ambitious targets. Working together, we can achieve them. And I'm very committed to putting CDC's international activities and support as a key partner for organizations within the U.S., for organizations globally, to achieve health aims. In blue, you see the parts of the world where CDC has existing operations. We have global disease detection centers in various countries becoming established or established, which track the spread of diseases, train people, establish laboratory services. Collaborations with the Department of Defense can be very important and effective. WHO cooperative agreements in many countries. Our influenza assignees and activities span the world as a key partnership to detect and track the spread and characteristics of influenza. The Global AIDS Program is active in more than 50 countries, with more than 35 countries direct involvement with the Ministry of Health. We're involved in 15 countries of the President's Malaria Initiative and expanding to others. And our field epidemiology training program continues to have assignees all over the world to help train the next generation of epidemiologists and public health managers in countries around the world. CDC's work in global health is a core part of our commitment. We are committed to putting our capacity to work in partnership with U.S. and global partners, and we really look forward to interacting with all of you and all of our work to try to help the world be a safer place where people live longer and healthier lives because we can have data that we trust and governments that can implement programs effectively. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I was struck by the emphasis you put on political leadership and how essential that dimension is for across the spectrum of things that you talk about. Tell us a little bit about how you think we can, as a government, better leverage political leadership and political commitments among partners.
That's a great question. There's no easy answer to it. I think the first is to have good data. Data on what the problems are and data on what we can do about them. The second is to be opportunistic in a good way. Mm-hmm. A good mayor comes in Mexico City and you have a smoke-free air ordinance within the first year. A good president comes in Uruguay, you have an effective program. taking the opportunities to support people who really are making a difference and identify the opportunities when they exist. Always being ready to take advantage of opportunities to move the ball forward in one area or another, whether it's in injury or non-communicable diseases or communicable diseases or capacity to development.
Thank you. That brings me to a second question, which has to do with engaging the American public. I mean, you're at the interface of both the domestic and the international. We're in the midst of a pretty difficult and complex debate around reform of our own health systems, very difficult budgetary debt deficit situation. What's your view on how you can best engage the American public around the agenda that you're describing for us today?
Well, as we all know, in this room, the American public vastly overestimates the amount we spend on global health. We spend a very small fraction of what Americans think we spend. We also need to do a better job explaining what we do with the dollar, both doing more and being able to document impact and bringing those stories home to people here, women who are healthy because of our programs, children who will grow up without HIV because of our programs, communities that are healthier and more vibrant because tuberculosis has been controlled and is no longer killing many of the most productive members of society. You know, Stalin said that one death is a tragedy and a million deaths is a statistic. In the same way, a million lives saved is a statistic and one life saved is a miracle. And I think we need to bring that home to people more.
Thank you. Why don't we move to invite some comments and questions from our audience. We have microphones that will come to you. Please identify yourself and offer a quick comment or question.
Hi, I'm Anne from the International Rescue Committee. Today you're in Washington, and here the administration is grappling with a new development policy, a new development approach. One of the ideas that's kicking around is that the U.S. should be more selective about the countries with which it partners to ensure that taxpayer money is not wasted and programs are run well. The flip side to that is that sometimes a lot of innocent people live in countries with corrupt and bad governments, and certainly diseases don't distinguish between good governance and bad governance. So what is your own thinking looking at these two streams of thought in Washington right now?
Another great question, and one to which I don't think there's any easy answer or single answer. A lot of what CDC does transcends any particular government. We're talking about building capacity, strengthening laboratories, fundamentally getting better information. You know the old saying, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not to your own facts. Right now we have too much opinion and too little fact in global health, and we need to continue to build the evidence base, build the knowledge base on what's actually happening. That can focus the mind on what needs to be done. Clearly, there are countries where we're not going to be able to make a big impact because of the political or economic or social or security situation. However, there are some conditions, like polio, where we need to make progress regardless of that, or guinea worm eradication or filariasis, where we need to try to make progress despite enormous challenges. I think at the same time, we do need to reward and support governments that are really making a commitment, and ultimately we want our dollars to go as far as possible. So where there's a context of high need and high commitment that goes together, we have to work effectively with those groups. I think one of the other challenges that often comes up, and that I have strong feelings about, and perhaps I'm in a minority view on this, is the issue of sustainability. Clearly, we should not be running programs that have limited impact and are not going to be able to be continued past a very episodic amount of aid. But in work that I've done over the past couple of decades in global health, I've often seen unsustainable used as an excuse not to run a program which may be very effective and very needed. And I have seen that occur in tuberculosis and HIV and malaria and other areas. It reminds me of somebody saying, well, I'm not going to rescue this drowning person today, because if he drowns again tomorrow, I may not be here to rescue him. what we know is that successful programs are much easier to sustain. Success breeds success. Success has 1,000 fathers and is more likely to get funded and supported. So our best way to defend the programs that we run is to run them well, or to help countries run them well.
Thank you. We have Armin in the back.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frieden, for your presentation. My name is Armin Fiedler. I'm the lead advisor for health policy and strategy at the World Bank, at the Human Development Network. Global health many times is synonymous with infectious diseases, communicable diseases, and I'm actually very glad that you pointed out kind of the rising threat of non-communicable diseases and even the need to invest in vital statistics, information, surveillance systems, etc. But many times the challenge is, I mean, to change the mind of our authorizing environment. Our senior leaders, presidents, prime ministers, whoever in our authorizing environment like to think of global health as infectious diseases for different reasons. One reason is perhaps lack of understanding of the importance of non-communicable diseases. But the other challenge is it's easy wins, things that can be sold to a parliament, you know, surviving babies, immunization, AIDS, etc. How do we address this, and how do we also make them understand that many times the binding constraints for health outcomes are actually not in the health sector. Issues of road safety, even maternal and child health, sometimes a road is the best intervention to save mothers' lives. I mean, how do we address this and not fall into this trap of this synonymous thinking of international health, global health equals infectious diseases?
Another great question, and another one that's not easy to answer. There's clearly a stronger mandate for global infectious disease control than there is for global non-communicable disease control and injury control. The leading cause of death in Americans who travel overseas is road traffic accidents, road traffic injuries, rather. So there are some areas in which it's in our self-interest. There are areas that I outlined earlier. It's in all of our interest to have a more productive society, more productive training partners. We need to address the felt needs of countries and the understandings of countries, and as countries realize that they're living through epidemics of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, stroke, this is what they want to address. So respecting that as a key need of developing countries, I think, is very important. But it is challenging, and I don't think there's an easy answer to your question. Fundamentally, it goes back to, I outlined at the beginning, a few different arguments for investing in global health, and I believe still the strongest one is the ethical one, that saving lives when they can be saved easily and with a minimum of investment is something that we have a responsibility to do.
Why don't we take a couple of different comments together? There's a gentleman right here in the front, and then right behind there, and then a woman in the back.
Yes. My name is Yon. I came from 20 hours flight from Indonesia, but last month. Smart global health policy. Smart issue with smart speaker. The indicator when he said smart question or unique question, he said difficult answer, is it? It is smart. So, I just wrote keywords, global healthy, mothers, and smart leaders. This is the keywords. So it's mean that the mission of this forum is partnering for rapid progress in global public health. Why we talk about global? Because globalization make world just only huge village. It means that we meet today not because the world is too small, but we fly too high, like me, fly from Indonesia here. So, how about the solution for safety to make global healthy? Mr. Thomas said two ways, strengthen public and government. It means that you're right, make it smart. Smart leader, not only clever. So, I just want to say that I came here also in dealing with to discuss a book in Chicago about bird flu viruses wrote by Siti Fadila Supari, who reformed WHO in bird flu viruses. So I will invite you there in Chicago. And then if CSIS interest to ask her to speak, I will tell her. Okay? Again, the author of the book means it's time for the world to change. So I agree, strengthen public and government. Not only clever, but smart leader. Thank you.
Thank you. Right behind here. Come back.
Hi, I'm Nancy Harris from JSI, and really applaud CDC's expansion into international health based on their reputation in the U.S., which carries a lot of momentum overseas. I have a very practical question. In recent days, CDC has issued a huge number of requests for applications for partnerships, only to have a lot of them either canceled after they've been awarded or even before, or greatly reduced in funding. This is very discouraging to potential partners. Is there a plan in sight to be more rational about the contracting process?
Okay, and let's take a third comment question in the back. Yes, right there. Sir, I'll come back to you in a moment.
Good morning. Thank you for your presentation. Tiaji Salam, Congressional Research Service. My question is about the Global Health Initiative. When I look at the numbers, it appears that most of the time when we talk about global health, we mostly focus on PEPFAR and USAID global health programs, but there's not a lot of discussion about CDC. And when you look at the figures and you add up the five-year strategy, I don't see an additive space for CDC, so I'm not clear exactly what the role of CDC might be in the Global Health Initiative. It seems that it'll just be a Global Health and Child Survival Account and Global Fund. So if you could kind of expound on what that is. I've looked through the CBJ and I still don't see like a specific CDC role. I just see general discussions about GHI. That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Should we come back to you?
Sure. In terms of the contracting issue, I'm not familiar with the details, but what often happens is we need to enter into contracts that will last 3, 5, or 7 years. We want to forecast as effectively as possible, and there's a balance between forecasting effectively and having contracts in place well in advance of when we'll actually be able to implement them and making unnecessary work, but we will certainly work to improve that. In terms of the CDC role in GHI, we're still working that through. There is a leadership group that includes Ambassador Goosby, Raj Shah, and myself as the operations committee of GHI. The first country visit to Kenya is in the field now, and we're thinking through how the principles of GHI and those goals that I showed will translate into specific programs. Of course, that will also depend on congressional allocations. So we'll see how that goes.
Thank you. We have down in front here, Carolyn, right here.
Diane Hajibego, Child and Human Services, ASPR. I have just one quick question. Health and conflict, and how do you see health as a mitigating factor in a conflict?
Thank you. Gentleman right here.
Jules Milogo, I'm a consultant. How do you see the coordination for global health? I mean, as someone born in developing countries, I'm very keen on, it worries me that sometimes you have the impression that there are so many pieces, initiatives, and it's really there are inefficiencies that are due to the fact that there is no coordination between the partners, including between USAID and CDC, by the way, and the lady from GSI may have hit a point where sometimes even NGOs that are funded by the U.S. government, sometimes there is no coordination among themselves. The second thing, I mean, if you have time to answer, is the sustainability of the training programs. Sometimes people are trained and then they are yanked from the system to work well for CDC. And you go in a country and you still find the same basic lack of people that are working for the government or within the government because they are all in NGOs or in international organizations, etc. And so it's really an issue where it seems a non-winning battle because the system just continues to lose people. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Right here. We have several international fellows with us this week, a couple of whom are global health practitioners.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I am a physician from Mexico. I want to know, what about chronic disease like diabetes, obesity? I don't know if it's inside the global agenda of CDC.
Should I come back to you?
Sure. So conflict issues would be a whole, I think, session. A lot of challenges, on coordination, on rapidity of action, on protection of human rights, on protection of women and children, and on the ability to monitor for conditions in real time that could be effectively treated. So I think lots of areas to discuss and a very important area to work on. Coordination is, in fact, one of the main reasons for the creation of the Global Health Initiative, to try to ensure that the U.S. works in a whole-of-government approach where we could ideally be one government working together, clarify what is USAID going to do, what is CDC going to do, what are we going to do together, how can we enrich each other's efforts, and how can we work most effectively with multilateral organizations and private donors and others to try to be as effective and cost-effective as possible. In terms of in-country training, the field epidemiology training programs have been pretty successful in that regard, and that more than three-quarters of the staff who are trained stay in-country. But the problem that you identify is a very real one. They may stay in-country but work for NGOs which pay more or international organizations which pay more. Many, we have found, do go back to the government, work with the government. But this is an area where political commitment, health sector work, political or State Department, USAID involvement will be very important. One of the things that we've been very ineffective in trying to do is convince health ministries to establish and enrich the career track for public health specialists and epidemiologists, and that's really important. And yes, non-communicable diseases and injuries are a critical part of our global portfolio. They're not included in the Global Health Initiative, but the infrastructure that will be supported through the Global Health Initiative can also be used to address non-communicable diseases.
If it's okay, let's take one more round of questions and comments, and then we'll come back to you, Tom, and you can close. Robert?
Mike McDonald, GHI. Haiti's an incredibly complex operating environment for CDC. And I just want to ask you how you see CDC succeeding in some of these dimensions. One, you have Cuba, who has signed an agreement to run public health and disease surveillance within Haiti, supported by Venezuela and Brazil. You have the Ministry of Health that has banned the rapid tests for malaria. You have surveillance systems that are breaking down. The formal systems are not reporting at high enough rates to really produce valid reports at this point. What do you see as the mechanisms for CDC shifting its approaches when it's facing these very complex environments?
Right behind you. a hand up. Yes.
Hi, my name is Tom Myers. I'm from AIDS Healthcare Foundation. A situation that's currently occurring now that seems to tie all the themes that you've spoken about together is currently what's happening with the situation in PEPFAR in Uganda and various other countries in terms of programs where success breeds success.
Speak up a bit more, please.
Mike may not be on, I think.
No, Mike's on.
Better? Okay, thanks. A program where success breeds success, the political will, sustainability. We've had reports about treatment slots being capped, the recent letter that the CDC sent to their partners back in October. I was wondering if you just comment on the current situation there and how it relates to the things that you've been talking about and what we can do to move forward in there.
Okay. Do you have any other in the back in the rear? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Allison Johnson. I'm here from Northrop Grumman Corporation. I work in the technical services sector. We also have representatives from the information systems sector, where we're doing a lot of work at CDC, and happy to work with you and your colleagues. My question is in regards to the very important emphasis that you've placed on capacity development and the strengthening of the global health environment around the world, and the funding mechanisms you see for that to take place, and whether there will be private sector corporations like Northrop Grumman and others that are going to be able to be partners with the federal government in building the capacity around the world. In particular, like the question from the researcher at the Congressional Research Service, where will the money from the federal government come from to provide this capacity building and development? And will it be funded through USAID or through your center? And will there be room for partners like private sector players? Thank you.
Thank you.
There are one more question.
One. Yeah, let's take two quick
comment questions. Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you. Nuala Moore with American Thoracic Society, and I want to thank you for your focus and all of your work on tuberculosis over the years. Given that CDC really has very strong technical expertise in controlling tuberculosis, both here in the U.S. and abroad, and also that they have some really good research capacity, there's a clinical drug trials consortium. What are the plans, you know, for expanding some of these research operations with respect to TB and getting more progress on reducing the global pandemic?
Okay. Take one last.
Hi, Dr. Frieden. Karen Gorleski from Research America. Thank you for taking time to be here today. So much of what you've talked about in terms of the successes of what CDC has done and the accomplishments that it hopes to achieve have a foundation of research. Yet Congress seems to not have such an accurate view of the important role that research plays at CDC. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you're going to change that mindset. And good luck.
Thank you. If anyone has any suggestions on how to change mindsets in Congress, please see me immediately afterwards. I think the last two questions related to research. So starting there, we do have a very important role in knowledge generation. It's something that I think often is not recognized or seen widely. And one of the things that we have to be better at is telling the story of what we have done, what we are doing, and what impact that's making in people's lives. So part of that is, I think, our own job to do better. And part of that is all of you to understand and help to spread the word on the work that's going on by any institution that's being effective in their work globally. In terms of the resources for the Global Health Initiative, it's going to have to first come from Congress. Then there will be decisions and plans made through partnerships between the Office of Global AIDS Coordination, USAID, CDC, and a strategic governing body that's much broader, includes many representatives from around the U.S. government, to think about where we need to be going on a policy level in the initiative. In terms of the relative balance between contractor versus agency operated, I think it very much depends on how the job can best be done, and particularly thinking about how we can be most cost effective. most effective and most cost-effective are really key for us. Haiti is absolutely an enormous challenge. I think one of the most effective ways to work effectively is to be there, to have the right kind of staff in country working respectfully with partners. We actually have had a very good collaboration with our Cuban counterparts on surveillance issues. We have similar goals, and we want to use health as a uniting force. You mentioned the issue of RDTs, and the ministry has understandable concerns about RDTs. They say, you know, we've seen attention come and we've seen attention go. We can't afford them. So why should we start something that we're not going to be able to continue? I think there's an answer to that, but I think it's a valid concern, not merely a kind of irrational objection. And there was another question that I can't read my notes about. Oh, yes, cap to AIDS treatment. We don't see there being a cap to AIDS treatment. There are times when the system is expanding rapidly, and we need to make sure that it expands through the whole country equitably rather than in some places. That's my understanding of what the concern was that I think your question relates to. But we are not at the situation at this point where we're limiting in any country in a general way the expansion. There is, though, a real need to optimize resources between the Global Fund, national resources, PEPFAR, other bilateral donors, and to really encourage other countries to step up and do their part as well with HIV/AIDS treatment. Fundamentally, global health is a global affair. The U.S. needs to do more, countries that are most affected need to do more, and other donors, both public and private, need to do more. We need to invest, as the CSIS report highlights, in effective work of multilateral institutions. We need to build the capacity both in this country and globally for effective work. And I really thank all of you for your interest and attention, because it's all of our commitment and your commitment that will help move global health to a much better place than it is today. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.